some career counseling for an incumbent.
Mr. Gillespie.
Yeah, that's me.
So you'd like to run for Congress in the 4th District.
Basically, I've always wanted to serve people, and I really think this will be a great job for me.
I'm looking at your resume here. Very, very strong. I see you're a Sunday school teacher.
Uh-huh.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Successful in business.
Oh, sure.
Excellent.
Sure.
I notice here that you aren't the congressman in the 4th District.
Well, that is true. But I just don't think people need to know I'm the incumbent. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. But don't you think that's something you'd want to put on the resume?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, got to leave something off.
Well, wouldn't that be relevant?
Maybe. I worked at a car wash once.
Uh-huh. Well, okay.
This year, politicians are reportedly discovering that being the incumbent can be a liability. When the I word is a bad word, it's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's July 30th. In Florida, powerful politicians are scratching the word incumbent from their campaign ads. We'll explain. Also today, the aftermath of Republican Senator Ted Stevens' indictments. U.S. goals in Iraq. Mice and men, proof that going hungry gives you a high, at least according to some scientists. And the Latino vote, larger than ever. Registration drives are in full swing. Those stories and all the news.
Charged with mass murder in the deadly siege of Sarajevo, the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic is in the custody of the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands. He's expected to make his first official appearance within days. 30 aftershocks have followed yesterday's 5.4 magnitude earthquake that rattled the Los Angeles area. Eric Pounders is a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
There's no way to know that this isn't a precursor of the main shock. There could ultimately be a larger earthquake.
The quake was felt as far east as Las Vegas. There were no reports of serious injuries or major damage.
Alaska Senator Ted Stevens could be facing the end of his career, already running against a tough Democratic challenger. Stevens has been indicted on 7 counts of failing to disclose tens of thousands of dollars in services from an oil company that helped renovate his home. The 84-year-old is the first U.S. senator to face federal indictment in 15 years. The House apologized yesterday to African Americans for the wrongs committed during slavery and Jim Crow segregation laws. The resolution marks the first time Congress has ever formally apologized for America's past history of enslaving and discriminating against African Americans.
In politics, Barack Obama is holding 2 town hall meetings in Missouri today. John McCain will start his day in Denver, Colorado, and end it in Kansas City, Missouri. Oil fell more than $2.50 yesterday. Boy, the markets love that. The Dow and the S&P up 2.5%. I'm interested in the incumbent story.
I like $122 a barrel.
Yeah, everybody loves
oil.
That.
Am I going to see
everybody
that at my gas pump anytime soon?
Starting to happen. Anyway, on the takeaway question today, everybody complains about their incumbent, but you all vote for them. It happens every single election year. Why?
After year.
Explain
after year.
It.
After
also,
year.
The House apologized for slavery. If you could frame an apology for slavery, what would it sound like? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Good morning, everybody. Of course, in Washington, the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
A federal grand jury here in the District of Columbia returned an indictment charging United States Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska with 7 felony counts of making false statements.
That's Matt Friedrich, acting Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, speaking at a news conference yesterday. Prosecutors say Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican, is expected to turn himself in to face those 7 felony charges. Stevens is accused of concealing home renovations and gifts from an oil contractor who'd lobbied him for government aid. Stevens says he's innocent and will prove it. Joining us now is Marty Cady, who writes for Politico.com. He's been following this story pretty huge down there in the Senate, Marty.
Yeah, this is an earthquake not only in the Senate chambers, but just a massive story in Alaska. Remember, when you fly to Alaska, you land at Ted Stevens International Airport. So you can't underestimate the importance of this figure in Alaskan politics.
But in terms of the Senate, does it reshake or reshape anything? Should other Republicans be concerned? And what does this do to committee assignments?
Well, First of all, he's been stripped of his ranking Republican committee assignments. If he was a chairman and if Republicans were in charge, he would have been stripped of his chairmanship. But he's no longer the ranking Republican on commerce. He had to give up his defense appropriations subcommittee ranking level there, meaning he won't be the guy who is helping control $500 billion in defense spending. And, I don't know if other Senate Republicans are worried. They were already pretty worried that a number of them were going to lose this year. But this just sort of adds another cloud over the Republican Party in Washington.
Well, in the middle of that cloud, Marty, here's what Ted Stevens said yesterday. You can kind of hear the reservation in his voice, but he's vowing to defend himself.
I've got to depend upon traveling the state and renewing acquaintances and make people understand what I have done and to tell them one single thing. I've been there for you. Every time you are in trouble. It looks like I might be in trouble this time, and I want you to be for me. Now, that's going to be the campaign.
Marty Cady writes for Politico.com. He's with us. You know, it sounds like, it's too early to say, but it sounds like, at least in the court of public opinion, Stevens' defense is, hey, I'm Ted Stevens. Come on. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, he's done so much for the state of Alaska, billions in earmarks. And one of the other things that you notice in his statement, though, he said, I never knowingly filed false reports, hid anything. It's one of those things where he's going to be like, I didn't know. But he must, he's Ted Stevens. He's been in the Senate for 40 years. He must have had ethics lawyers who handle his financial disclosure forms.
Well, not only that, Marty, but ignorance of the law is never a defense.
No, it's not. And it's really stunning that that it's come to this. I mean, the raid on his house was a year ago, so this didn't come out of the blue. This has been going for a long time, but he's basically saying, they call him Uncle Ted in Alaska. I talked to people up in Alaska, and they said, people, they're flooding his office with calls and emails saying, we're behind you, so, we might be frenzied here in Washington, but there's a huge base for him in Alaska.
Well, the question really is not so much does this realign the Senate in some way. I mean, I don't believe the Democrats are expected to lose the Senate or in danger of doing that in this fall. But on things like cloture votes, where you need 60 votes, could this be decisive?
Sure. I mean, there's talk today that if Stevens loses his race, if he either resigns or if he just simply loses to a very strong Democratic opponent who's the mayor of Anchorage, this gets the Democrats one step closer to this 60-vote threshold where they could pretty much, run the Senate with impunity without many Republicans in the way. As it is, at least three or four Republican senators are expected to lose, and that's the Republican prediction. The Democrats are thinking it could be close to 6, 7, or 8, which puts them very close to that magic number of 60 in the Senate.
Is there any way to say, and we're going to shift in a moment and talk about some of the broader history in the Senate of these kinds of charges, but before we go with you, Marty, is there any way to say this is a gray area? I mean, you're in the Senate that long, you have relationships, a state as small as Alaska, come on.
There is one thing that's interesting in the indictment is that they did not charge him with bribery. I followed the Bob Ney and the Duke Cunningham cases, went to the Justice Department when those guys were charged, and it said, you took this and gave this. It was like cash for stuff, the classic quid pro quo. These are the charges against Ted Stevens are filing false statements, so it sounds like it's not quite as bad as outright bribery. Mm-hmm. The indictment looks very bad when you read through all 28 pages or so of it. But I wonder if he's got some wiggle room there to say, well, filing false statements, I did pay them, but I didn't file this paperwork. So, he says he's going to fight it, but you have to see that in the first 24 hours for
right.
this happens.
Right.
Let's
well, there's legal.
There, in the next couple days.
There's legal wiggle room, and then there's political wiggle room. Marty right. Cady, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Marty Cady writes for Politico.com. Adora?
You're absolutely right. Big difference between that political wiggle room and that legal wiggle room. We're going to take a look at other aspects of the indictments against Senator Ted Stevens. He's such an iconic figure, John, in Alaska, that they call him the second engine in the economy. So what does his troubles mean for the Republicans on the Hill, but also for the folks in Alaska? Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School and the author of On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences. Well, Julian, that's a big job. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you've studied corruption and politics a long time. What was your first thought when you heard about the indictments against Senator Stevens?
Well, the first thought is this is a period when Republicans just can't afford one more face of corruption in their party. We go through moments when there's a lot of cases like we've seen in the last 2 years, and that's when each particular scandal becomes very damaging. And I think that's where Republicans are right now.
And there's really two levels to the timing. One is you have a period, as you've noted, that 2006, there was a lot swirling around Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist, and allegations of corruption. And he was actually convicted with some associated charges not long ago. However, Republicans thought they had almost kind of moved past that a bit, and now this Stevens indictment brings all these issues back up again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, this scandal hits Republicans in three ways. One is, are the Democrats going to get a filibuster-proof Senate, which is what they want? Two is the image of the Republican Party. And you're right, they've finally moved beyond Jack Abramoff, and here's Ted Stevens. And that's just not what they can afford. That was one of the two top issues in 2006. And third is how this affects the presidential campaign and if it hurts John McCain.
And not only that, but the second level perhaps would be what's happening for Ted Stevens, which is he's facing an Alaskan Republican primary. That's just a couple of weeks away. And then you're just a month away from the Republican convention. So politically, in terms of wiggle room, how much do you think that he has, and how much pressure will there be on him by the Republicans in power for him to step aside so it won't be center, it won't be front and center?
There's going to be a lot of pressure on the leadership. I mean, sometimes voters have been forgiving to members of Congress. There was a big scandal with a member of the House in 1974, a sex scandal involving a guy named Wilbur Mills, who's caught in the tidal basin with a stripper who he was having an affair with, and voters reelect him 1 month later. Voters often like their members. They like their incumbent, and they're willing to forgive him. That said, this is a moment the pressure from the Republican leadership will be immense. They just can't afford to have him in the news. Newspapers in August and September. They need other news right now. So it's going to be a matter of who wins out, you know, the interests of the leadership or kind of the loyalty of voters.
I'm not sure if you heard our last guest, but he talked about how when you arrive in Alaska, one of the airports there is named after Ted Stevens, that he's such an iconic political figure. What does this mean in Alaska, and how do you think how much do you think voters will hold this against him?
Well, I mean, I think the scandal matters a lot for Alaska. No state wants their member to become the source or face of corruption in Washington, D.C. It also could cost Alaska a lot. I mean, this is a guy who was known to bring home the goods, which is part of probably how he got into this mess right now. They'd often go hand in hand. Incumbents who bring back goodies for their state and for their district often, you know, go too far. But that said, he's brought a lot back, and it sounds like that's what he's going to base his campaign on. I have not only been there for you, I have brought a lot back for you. And he's going to remind them, if they lose this senior Republican, they can go low on the seniority ladder in the Senate, and that could mean a lot for the state. And, you know, that could be an effective argument in a state like Alaska.
Julian, is Ted Stevens the guy who did the Bridge to Nowhere?
Yes, and that's how he became famous.
Boy, let's just kind of leave it there, huh? Bridge to Nowhere, huh?
I know, just to throw in some numbers, the LA Times report, 1,452 pork barrel proposals worth $3.4 billion between 1995 and 2008 to the folks in Alaska. Julian Zelizer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Julian Zelizer is a congressional historian at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He's also the author on Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences.
That struggle just got a little more challenging after yesterday, that's for sure.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this unfolds. It's a big political year, as we know.
Bridge to Nowhere. More about bridges, actually, in the show coming up. Good morning, everybody. With the troubles of Senator Ted Stevens emerging yesterday, the people of Alaska are certainly thinking about incumbency. We want you to think about it as well. Americans overwhelmingly elect incumbents to Congress. Maybe they won't this year, but we want to know why. Americans talk about wanting to throw the bums out, but they almost never do. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Why would you throw out an incumbent or vote for one in this election? MyTake at thetakeaway.org is also the way to reach us. Also working its way through Congress is an official apology for slavery and the Jim Crow segregation laws. If you wanted to hear an apology, what would it sound like? Phrase it for us and reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or
If you want to phrase the apology, what would you say to apologize for those enormously important historic events that are still circulating in American culture today? 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's the takeaway question for today. We've been talking continually on this program about what the long-term end game or just the role the U.S. will play in Iraq going forward as the U.S. and Iraq negotiate the end-of-the-year agreement, which will allow U.S. troops to stay in Iraq and outline the relationship between the Iraqi government and U.S. forces in that country. The new mandate was supposed to be negotiated by the end of this month. It looks like that deadline will be missed. It needs to be negotiated by the end of the year when the U.N. mandate, which allows the U.S. to operate in Iraq, will run out. Joining us to talk about Iraqi sovereignty, U.S. occupation, and the issues at stake in these negotiations is John Fisher Burns, London bureau chief for the New York Times, former Baghdad bureau chief, and foreign correspondent for the New York Times. John, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
First of all, did you ever think that these negotiations would be going on when you began your stint in Baghdad sometime before 2003?
Who among us would dare say that 5 years ago we could have predicted anything about this war? I think most of us believed, utterly mistakenly, as it turns out, that that the American military enterprise in Iraq would have been concluded long ago. So no, we didn't foresee this. But this issue now under discussion, under argument and debate between the United States and the government in Iraq has a long history and is quite opaque.
Well, let's talk about the details for a minute. What's curious to me is how these discussions have preempted, on the one hand, the Iraqi government, which probably should be working out its issues of sovereignty in its own parliament, but instead is working them out in these negotiations. And it's also preempted the campaign discussion of Iraq in the United States, in the sense that what the U.S. is going to be doing in 2009 is going to be decided here. It's not going to be decided by the voters in November. Isn't that curious? And what are the demands on the table for the Iraqis?
Well, I think to deal with the first part of that, since I'm a correspondent covering events overseas and not in the United States, there's a huge complication here, which is that Iraqi politicians are obliged or feel themselves obliged to posture somewhat over these issues because no party, no Iraqi party wishes to be seen to be prolonging any longer than is necessary the occupation, as they call it, of Iraq. This doesn't necessarily square with the facts on the ground that are recognized in private by some of those same Iraqi leaders. And we're at a critical stage of this war, as you know, where violence is very sharply down by 80% or so in Baghdad, by 60% or thereabouts across the country. And as General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker have repeatedly pointed out, the advances that have been made over the past year are fragile and reversible. So to project what a necessary American troop strength might be or for how long is at this stage extremely difficult, not just for the United States, but for the Iraqi leaders themselves.
So when the Iraqi leaders look around their country and see the enormous investments that the U.S. has made, the Bush administration claims these are not permanent bases. From the Iraqi perspective, what is it that they're demanding of these billion-dollar facilities that have been constructed all over the country?
Well, of course, in an ideal world, they would wish to inherit it all themselves. The question is, how quickly can their armed forces progress to the point where they can, in fact, take overall responsibility for their own security? And objectively, as I understand it, and I've been gone for some time now, the Iraqi armed forces, although they have made great strides in the field, remain, in the matter of logistics in particular, very dependent on the United States and very dependent on American air power, supplies, and support, and on American units that are attached to the principal Iraqi combat units. And from what I know of this, and as I say, I have to say I've not been there for some time, but from what I know of it, it's going to take some time, probably some years, for those basic problems of the, in the Iraqi military to be solved.
And John, do you think that Nouri al-Maliki, is he the person to make those changes sustained and substantive?
Well, I have to say, like so much else about Iraq in the past year, Nouri al-Maliki, I think, has been something of a surprise. In his first year in office, he drove American military commanders and diplomats to distraction. They thought that they had yet another Iraqi leader who was simply not competent for the job, that in short the United States did not have what President Bush repeatedly referred to as a partner in this enterprise. But in the past year, of course, he's done a number of things, including most famously, I think, sending the Iraqi army into Basra a couple of months ago, and has shown a good deal more grit and a good deal more in the way of leadership ability than anybody would have thought. But he's still a politician. He still has an eye not just on the Sunni competition in the parliament in Baghdad, but on his own Shiite rivals. And so what he says publicly about the issue of American troop strength and the lengths under which American troops might yet be based in Iraq has to be, I think, looked at very carefully, because it doesn't necessarily square with the facts on the ground.
Well, you know, there was an agreement just a week or so ago about this sort of time horizon of a withdrawal of U.S. forces. What do you think, in the last minute we have here before we go, do you think the U.S. presence 5 years from now is going to look like Okinawa? Is it going to look like Germany? Is it going to look like the Korean DMZ in terms of the aftermath of this war long term?
Well, of course, that's what we would all wish. And indeed, the events seem to be moving in a direction where we can actually begin to hope that that will be the case. But much depends on what happens in the next round of American military drawdown. If stability, or some degree of stability, if the progress made in the past year is sustained, yes, we can hope for that, for a soft landing. But I think it's too early to say.
Soft landing long term, though, and hopes for peace at this point. But certainly it's not going to be like Vietnam, where we're gone and that's the end of it.
I don't think anybody who's put his boots on the ground believes that's possible.
All right, John, thanks so much for joining us. John Fisher Burns, a London bureau chief for the New York Times, formerly Baghdad bureau chief. Thanks, John.
Good morning to you. It's July 30th, and what day of the week would it make that, John?
Today's Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a trick question.
I see.
No more trick questions. We're going to go to the latest headline from Femi. Okay. Femi?
27 minutes to the hour. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Phew. Goodness me. I got the easy one. He's been indicted on 7 felony counts, but Alaska Senator Ted Stevens says he is innocent. Stevens is accused of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from an oil company. The wildfire burning near Yosemite National Park has destroyed 25 homes and is only 15% contained. It's the busiest time of year at Yosemite, but the fire is threatening to drive visitors away. For the first time ever, Congress has formally apologized to Black Americans for the country's history of slavery and discrimination. The House passed the resolution yesterday. Let me give you an idea of what the resolution actually said. It said that Africans were forced into slavery, and I quote, they were brutalized, humiliated, dehumanized, excuse me, and subjected to the indignity of being stripped of their names and their heritage. The resolution was the work of Steve Cohen. He's a Tennessee Democrat. And Cohen is the only white lawmaker to represent a majority black district. Now, 5 states have issued apologies for slavery in the past, and those states include Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Alabama, and New Jersey, which was the only northern state to do so. And the resolution did not mention any reparations, but Congress has issued apologies before to Japanese Americans for internment during World War II and to Hawaiians for their overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Also, in other news, the New York Times is reporting that the CIA is accusing the Pakistani intelligence agency of working with militants accused of increasing violence in Pakistan's tribal areas and parts of Afghanistan. And the World Food Programme says that North Korea is facing the worst food crisis in almost 2 decades. 5 to 6 million people could be facing starvation if they don't get more aid soon. And that's a look at your national and international headlines.
Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to turn to Florida now, where, of course, many are watching the presidential race very, very closely. But there are also some important state races unfolding there with some interesting twists. Joining us now is Roger Austin, an independent political consultant. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. How's it going?
Very well. And yourself?
We're doing great down here. It's always good in Gainesville, home of the Florida Gators.
You had to get that in there, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Listen, in the state
Absolutely.
Of Florida, there are two very powerful state senators up for re-election. Let's listen to a bit of a campaign ad for one of them. This is for J.D. Alexander.
We're facing challenges today that have all of us concerned and talking. But far too often, politicians do too much talking and very little doing. That's not my style.
Roger, what's missing from that?
Well, apparently, what's missing is the word reelect. I got a call a week or so ago from a reporter down here asking about a trend that I had just started noticing myself of some incumbent politicians who are the only ones who are allowed to use the word reelect by law, and some of them are leaving that out of their campaign literature and, I guess, commercials. They're just not saying re-elect, they're saying elect me.
Let's listen to Jeff Atwaters. He's another very powerful state legislator there in Florida. Here's his ad.
I spent a lifetime helping Floridians, looking for a break. I'm not about to stop now.
Senator Jeff Atwater, the change we're looking for.
Now, these two politicians combined have spent 18 years in Austin. Is there a sense here that in Jeff Atwater's ad that perhaps there's an Obama influence talking about change? He's been in office a long time.
Well, actually, Atwater's only been there, I'd say maybe 2000 or 2002. But he is about to become the Senate president, so he's a pretty powerful senator down here in the state of Florida.
Well, let's talk about that trend. Not using the word reelect, not using the word incumbent. Dirty words? What's wrong with them?
Well, I don't know that anything's wrong with them, but the political environment this year isn't particularly good, and especially for incumbents. Republicans everywhere are also having some problems, but the Republican brand's a little tarnished. The incumbent brand is a little tarnished. And I guess incumbents everywhere running for re-election are feeling a little bit of heat in the political environment we're running in.
How do you make an argument for change if you're the incumbent? I mean, I changed, so then therefore Florida will change. I mean, you can't be an agent for change if you're the incumbent.
Oh, sure you can.
How?
I think politicians of all stripes are kind of in the business of getting reelected. So they want to go ahead and get out in front of what's already coming their way. I think last year when the various presidential campaigns were having to frame their arguments and their campaigns for this year, I guess the two best examples of that were Hillary and Obama. And Obama chose the change thing because he probably couldn't use the experience thing. Hillary used the experience thing. And it ended up, as this year has played out, change was the big issue this year. And you're seeing politicians of new politicians, old politicians, Republican politicians, Democrat politicians all wanting to get on the change bandwagon because that's the, the flavor of the year this year.
But Roger,
you sound so cynical. So it's just a question of rearranging the Scrabble words on the board?
I wouldn't say it exactly like that, but I'm not trying to be cynical so much as perhaps realistic that politicians and those seeking public office are in the game to win.
Well, do you think Jeff Atwater here, just listening to that ad, do you think he's trying to leave the impression that he actually isn't the incumbent, that he actually is a new politician coming from somewhere else?
Or even better yet, not a Republican but a Democrat?
I don't know about the latter, but I think if you walk away with that impression that he is not the incumbent, he probably wouldn't mind. Although in the ad he does say Senator Atwater, so
right.
If you put two and two together, you can figure it out. But by law down here in Florida, you've got to put your party affiliation. Under the federal law, I don't think you have to do that. But in Florida, you have to put your party affiliation on every ad.
It's all about branding.
That you do.
We've got about a minute left, but you've got a moral of this story. You think the public is just simply mad at all politicians, regardless of their stripes?
Absolutely. Voters everywhere are upset at politicians. And I think there's just a general sense among the voters that politicians of all stripes overspend, overpromise, and underdeliver, and don't always tell the truth. And so they're very suspicious. And the polling that I've done all around the state of Florida, we ask kind of the right track, wrong track question, and a job performance question on whether it's a legislature, a county commission, a school board, you know, whatever body it is.
Right.
And voters are upset.
They're upset. Roger Austin, thank you so much. I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there.
All right. Thanks, John. Thanks,
voters are
Thanks, Roger.
Upset. Roger Austin, political consultant, an independent political consultant in Florida. Thanks so much for your time. Good morning. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. On the line is Dr. Michael Luter of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. Luter, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you have solved a gigantic mystery for me. When my wife gets hungry, she's grumpy. But when I get hungry, I'm happy. Why does that happen to me?
Well, I guess what we've found is that mood is kind of closely linked to appetite, and that in there's sort of a two-phase reaction that occurs in most people under stress. In the first part of the phase, people sort of become they don't eat very much, they're not very hungry, and they're sort of socially withdrawn and isolated. And then as time progresses, that sort of reverses, and there are changes in your body which then lead you to become more socially active, more motivated, and hungrier.
And basically, a study that you're a part of here has determined that, in fact, hunger tends to release a certain hormone that uplifts your spirits, actually is there when you're under stress, and is actually kind of a happy hormone that, I guess, helps us to, you know, have the energy to get up and get some food. What's going on in our bodies?
Well, I'm trained as a psychiatrist, so I always hesitate to say that it makes people happy. I sort of think of depressed people as people who are unable to really experience happiness. What I would say is that the hormone ghrelin, which is released either by hunger or by stress, sort of increases your ability to experience happiness, and it increases your motivation to obtain rewarding experiences. So when you're under a lot of stress or you're hungry or things like that, the ghrelin is released and sort of makes you more alert and awake and active. But it also sensitizes sort of the neurons in your brain that sense reward and makes you more likely to sort of enjoy things and be happier when you do obtain something nice.
Well, when I do this show in the morning, I don't eat. And if I actually do for one reason or another, I definitely feel a letdown. So is it possible that this ghrelin hormone is what's keeping my sort of spirits up, even though I'm starving myself all morning long?
It could be. I suspect in some individuals that ghrelin probably does have sort of an arousing effect, that it kind of makes you more awake and alert and kind of more attuned to the environment and things like that. Ghrelin is known to sort of be secreted in a circadian pattern so that it peaks sort of in the right before mealtime. So if you get yourself into a routine in which you sort of hold off your meals and then have one later in the day, probably the ghrelin would peak in that time right before it.
Well, this was a mouse study that you reported about here, but explain to me what the implications are in the few seconds we have for people who want to lose weight. Is this something that helps you strategically if you're dieting, or something that gets in the way?
Well, presumably ghrelin would go up when people are losing weight. It's part of the reason that some people suspect that it's hard to lose weight, because your body kind of tries to hold on to energy stores. We would predict, though, that in individuals who are losing moderate amounts of weight, not starving themselves, but, you know, on a reasonable diet, that they would probably experience some benefit in terms of their mood, that they would be sort of happier and more alert. And there is some evidence for this.
There's certainly evidence for crazy, addicted dieters who love to lose weight and who claim a sort of a broad, life-extending advantage. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Michael Luter is at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Hunger, happiness. Wow.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 30th, and we have the latest headline for you from Femi Okay. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the hour. He's been indicted on 7 felony counts, but Alaska Senator Ted Stevens says he's innocent and saddened by the charges against him. Stevens is accused of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from an oil company. In a historic move, the House has apologized to black Americans for the wrongs committed against them and their ancestors who suffered under slavery and Jim Crow segregation laws. Australian officials say that an exploding oxygen cylinder blew a car-sized hole in the fuselage of a Qantas Airways jet last week, forcing the plane to make an emergency landing in the Philippines. All 365 passengers on board were unhurt. And at 11:42 yesterday morning, the local LA council meeting was business as usual until the councillors were given a 5.4 magnitude jolt.
And there goes the earthquake. Earthquake, earthquake.
We're experiencing an earthquake. Earthquake. Please.
We got an earthquake.
Well, that went on for a little while. He went on for about 23 seconds. I'm imagining that the entire earthquake lasted about 30 seconds. But it seemed to, when you're watching it and you can see the councillors panicking and they're running to the side of the building and you're hearing him saying, earthquake,
get under
earthquake.
The doorway.
They can call for an earthquake in the LA City Council. I didn't think they were that powerful.
I think he was stating the obvious. I think he was in shock. Talking about shocks, there were 50 aftershocks and the seismologist at Caltech said that this could be the drill for the big one, but there's only a slight chance that this was a foreshock for a bigger earthquake.
And no injuries have been reported associated with the earthquake.
No, and just a little bit of damage.
Why we can chuckle a bit about it.
Yeah. Earthquake. I love that soundbite. But luckily nobody was hurt.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks very
You're
much,
You're very
Femi.
Welcome.
Obviously, it's a big political year, and there's just simply no question that the growing Latino population could potentially have a huge impact on the presidential elections. One example is if you look back to 2004 in New Mexico, John Kerry, the Democratic candidate, lost by 6,000 votes. There were 40,000 Latinos who did not vote. They could have potentially swung the result there. The real question this year is whether the potential change makers will get registered and then vote, which is a key goal of both parties who are vying for their support. The National Latino Congress has launched a huge effort to get people registered. Two of the organizers are joining us now. Alvaro Fernandez from Miami, Florida, or you're in Miami, Florida, I should say, and Jaime Chavez coming to us from New Mexico. So welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
So what's the strategy here? In 2004, only 58% of eligible Latino voters were registered. What are you going to do differently this year that perhaps wasn't done in prior registration drives? And Alvaro, let me start with you. Alvaro.
Well, differently, not much. What we're doing is registering every voter we can get our hands on, make sure they are registered, and then on Election Day and before Election Day, we will make sure they vote. At least the ones we've registered, we usually turn them out at about an 80% clip.
And how do you do that, Jaime? So what's the exact strategy? You find someone who's not registered, you get them registered, and then do you stay in contact over some period of time to encourage them to get to the polls?
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, in 2004, we registered 18,000 new registered voters. They're part of our database and our ongoing contact, okay? Plus, we, in this new round, both 2006 and also this presidential cycle, we're focused in community as well. We are now in our 10-12 campaign, and we're building steering committees out of the community, okay? We don't just kind of parachute in there. We actually build relationships with leaders in communities, and we do this both in urban and rural areas in New Mexico. And, yes, we're both a swing state and a battleground state. So there's a lot of competition in New Mexico to see, who's going to deliver the vote.
And Jaime, you're talking about how you have to build a specific strategy because Latinos are not a uniform, a monolithic group, right? And depending on where your geography is or what issues are most important to the community that you're living in, how does that affect the way that you are setting up these efforts?
Well, it obviously has to be from the self-interest of the community. As you said, we're not a monolithic community. Many of the same issues that are affecting the broader nation are affecting us in the micro level of our community right now. The issue of employment, the issue of housing, the issue, of course, of immigration, the issue of the war. These are all very hot button issues, and we saw during this primary a surge of interest of people coming forward and wanting to participate in this election cycle. We think it's going to carry out, of course, to November as well. So there hasn't been this kind of excitement that we've seen, and statistically has been shown, I think, since the Kennedy era.
Alvaro, what sorts of impediments are there to make it difficult to register people? And are there reluctances on the part of certain members of the community to actually get involved in politics that you need to convince people to put aside to join and register?
Actually, this year has been an interesting year in the sense that, you know, compared to 04 and beyond, you know, because of many of the troubles we experienced in Florida, people were reluctant to register. There's been a new interest, an excitement, and we're seeing it with, you know, when we approach people to register to vote, most who are not will register. Without, you know, questioning it. So you see that excitement. As far as impediments, the biggest impediment we have, I think, here in Florida is probably the state and the authorities that, you know, keep putting up new rules and regulations and what we can and can't do to register them to vote. So, you know, it's but, you know, we will not and we won't allow, you know, state or the authorities to stop us from registering people who have the right to vote.
Do you think there's one issue that's really driving people to participate? I mean, overall, in general, you look at the voter base, there's been a tremendous amount of involvement through the primary process that we haven't seen in a long time for all voters. In the Latino community, is there one particular issue that is really inspiring people to get involved?
You know, I think there's the Latino community is like any other community in the United States. Sure, immigration is important, but you know we are also experiencing problems with the economy. Like Jaime said, you know, jobs and the war in Iraq are all important issues.
Very important issue, and lots of time to come. How many folks are involved in this effort to register folks?
Go ahead, Jaime.
Go ahead, Alvaro.
Well, we're dealing with, you know, with our group alone, we're talking about a couple of 100 people doing work constantly, and there are many other groups doing the same thing in Florida. So, you know, Florida is the third state with more than 1 million Latino voters, and we hope to raise that number to 1.5 million by the end of by Election Day.
Jaime, you were going to add something?
Well, basically, what I was going to say is that there's a lot of excitement. There are also some impediments to voters registration in New Mexico, and it's what Alvaro said. You know, the rules and the regulations sometimes become stringent and are actually being challenged as we speak right now legally. Now, however, in spite of that, you know, we have the tenacity with which to go after this in rural areas in New Mexico, which are far apart. Even though we concentrate our areas in some of the key urban areas like in Bernalillo County and in Doña Ana County, we handle a lot of the outlying areas. So
you sound like two very tenacious and foot stomping organizers, and you've got two very challenging big states to work there. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
It's Alvaro Fernandez in Miami, Florida, and Jaime Chavez in New Mexico. They are voter registration organizers for the National Latino Congress.
We're always on here at The Takeaway, so you can find us online, streaming at Friend Feed on Facebook. You can come around to thetakeaway.org and visit. There's plenty to do.
And we're still asking folks, you complain about your incumbent, but then you still vote for them. Why? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And, you know, here is The Takeaway for today, folks.
Who among us would dare say that 5 years ago we could have predicted anything about this war?
That was John Burns, former Baghdad bureau chief and foreign correspondent for the New York Times. What do you think about incumbents?
John, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. The electorate is so underestimated by political operatives. I've run campaigns and organized them for years now, and I'll tell you, the electorate is not that stupid. And we don't just sway back and forth, myself and others, because someone says I'm a new change.
All right, you're smarter than we think, and I love that. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
Taking the Oath.
I, George Walker Bush.
I, George Walker Bush.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
We know the oath that President Bush took when he was inaugurated, but what demand for loyalty was made of other people in the Bush administration? Oaths and pledges for underlings on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's July 30th, Wednesday. A closer look today at a blistering Justice Department report accusing former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez of breaking the rules and asking for those pledges. Also, Republican Senator Ted Stevens is under indictment. What does that mean for the Senate? We're coming up on the anniversary of the Minneapolis bridge collapse. It's motivating a hard look at the nation's bridges, and there are problems. Those stories and all the news.
Charged with mass murder and the deadly siege of Sarajevo, the former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic is in the custody of the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands. He's expected to make his first court appearance tomorrow. 30 aftershocks have followed the 5.4 magnitude earthquake that rattled Los Angeles yesterday afternoon. Wendy Gruhl is the city's acting mayor. She says the chance that the quake yesterday was a precursor to a bigger quake is not high, but the city's still prepared.
In the event of an aftershock, and a large aftershock, we will activate a localized plan to provide shelters at city facilities.
Fortunately, though, there were no reports of serious injuries or major damage.
Alaska Senator Ted Stevens has been indicted on 7 felony counts, accused of failing to disclose tens of thousands of dollars in service from an oil company that helped renovate his home. The 84-year-old is the first sitting U.S. senator to face federal indictment in 15 years. The House apologized yesterday to African Americans for the wrongs committed during slavery and Jim Crow segregation laws, those decades when those were in effect. The resolution marks the first time Congress has ever formally apologized for America's past history of slavery and legally enforced discrimination.
7 years of trade talks involving more than 150 countries, the so-called Doha Round, have collapsed. Supporters say a free trade deal could have pumped $100 billion into the world economy, much of it to the developing world. Instead, trade chaos will rule, at least until the talks begin again. In politics today, Barack Obama is holding 2 town hall meetings on the economy in Missouri today. John McCain will start his day in Denver, Colorado. Oil fell more than $2.50 yesterday. It's in a virtual recession. It's at $122 a barrel. The markets, of course, love that. The S&P and the Dow were up nearly 2.5%. The S&P opens today at 1263.
I have to say that's my favorite story, too, $122 a barrel, because I just know when I go to the gas station, my gas is going to be $1 less a gallon.
Yeah, well, inshallah, as we say in the Middle East. The takeaway question we could ask, do you like oil prices going down? But then everyone would say yes, and we'd get no responses. So instead, we want to talk about incumbency. Everybody votes for incumbents, even though they complain about them. Why? Give us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Also, the apology for slavery. Interesting story in the House. If you were to apologize for something so enormous, how would you phrase that? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Good morning, everybody. We mentioned a moment ago the earthquake in the Los Angeles area yesterday. Well, they know something about earthquakes up in Alaska, and I'm not talking about geologic earthquakes. I'm talking about political earthquakes. As we also mentioned, Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican senator in the U.S. Senate, was indicted yesterday on 7 felony counts. He says he's going to surrender to the authorities and face those charges, although he says he's innocent. Joining us now is Libby Casey, who's Washington correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. She joins us by phone from D.C. This is a political earthquake for the state of Alaska, Libby. Explain what may be going on in Anchorage and around the state this morning as people get up and read the news.
You know, John, it's shocking in so many ways because Senator Ted Stevens has been in office for about 40 years. Remember, Alaska's only been a state for 50 years, and he spent wow. those decades really delivering for Alaska. He's known for finding ways to fund projects and help a state that's so young and doesn't have the infrastructure that you might have on the East Coast. But people know that this could have been coming. His home in Alaska, in Girdwood, near Anchorage, was raided last year by the FBI. And so we've known for a year now that this could be the result.
Now, Senator Stevens says he's innocent, and I want to play some tape of the senator sort of explaining himself and explaining where we go from here. But before we do that, what do you think the strategy is for the senator, and what do you think the strategy is in the Senate for trying to minimize the impact of these charges?
Well, Senator Stevens is going to come out fighting. I mean, he's saying that he's innocent of these charges and that he plans to fight it. He's running for re-election this year, and he's facing the toughest competition he has in a long time from a Democrat, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich. And Begich has been doing quite well in the polls. Now, Senator Stevens' campaign office put out a statement yesterday saying they're not giving up. This is not the end. You know, this is just the beginning of the campaign. And as far as what this means in the Senate, that'll really unfold over this week before everyone heads back to their home states for the recess on Friday. This is tough, though. This could be a bigger hit for the Republicans, and this kind of might chink open that window the Democrats have to gain some ground on this seat.
Well, you spoke with the senator actually a couple of days ago, and here's a very revealing clip that I'm going to play for us now that gives an indication of both his strategy and his appeal to the voters and just how tough Ted Stevens is.
I was chairman of the Ethics Committee. I've been elected to every office but one you can hold in the Senate. All of those things, you don't get selected to do that if you're known to be in any way tainted by personal misconduct. I really pride myself in terms of my record as a lawyer, as a U.S. attorney. You don't get the presidential appointments that I've had in the past if you have a flaw in your character. I don't think I do.
Libby, that's the Ted Stevens defense, basically saying, I'm Ted Stevens. Forget about it.
Yeah, and he's got so many friends back in Alaska. There's a lot of loyalty. I mean, we call him Uncle Ted. And, you know, I know people who are stalwart, diehard Democrats who still support Ted Stevens because over the years he's delivered from them everything from funding a nonprofit to helping, a daughter get out of Central America when she was, serving overseas and nobody else could help get her back home to Alaska. There's a lot of loyalty there. But Alaskans are sick of the corruption scandals. There's been an ongoing investigation for about 4 years now looking into corruption in the state. Multiple Alaskan state legislators have been convicted of extortion and bribery. There have been 7 convictions so far centering around this oil services company, Uveco, and Alaskans are pretty burnt out on it. You know, it's been a major headline in our newspapers and on the radio for the last couple of years, and everyone's wondering how high up does it go?
Well, it's a big theme for the campaign as Ted Stevens attempts to defend himself here. The Republicans in the Senate in Washington hope it's not a theme nationally. Libby Casey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, John.
Libby Casey is Washington correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network, where it's a 8 on the Richter scale political earthquake up in
that
state.
Yeah, I was going to say, not only in Alaska, I mean, you've got the earthquake on both coasts, right? You got it in D.C. and you got it in Alaska, and you also have a lot of activity down in Guantanamo Bay. It's week 2 of the military tribunal against Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, accused of conspiring and abetting terrorism. We've been talking to many observers as this unprecedented case has unfolded. And today we turn to Ben Wisner, a staff attorney for the ACLU, an organization that's gone to court challenging the Bush administration's policy here on those detainees. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Adora, and I hope the sound is okay. I'm actually calling you from an air-conditioned tent in what they call Camp Justice here, and that's where they've put the non-governmental observers and also the journalists. It's where we're sleeping, and it's where we do our work.
At least they gave you air conditioning.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And how. We all have runny noses.
Listen, you've covered many military trials over the years. How is this one different from others?
Well, actually, I've been coming down here for several years for pretrial proceedings in a number of cases, but this is the very first military tribunal that the government has actually undertaken since Nuremberg in Tokyo. And what's really striking, and I think I'd have to say embarrassing about this, is that the testimony has shown that Hamdan is not just a marginal figure. He's a cooperating witness. This is a guy who sat through literally dozens of interviews with FBI agents, with military investigators. He was described as polite, cordial, amiable. He identified dozens of photographs of al-Qaeda leaders. He described how Osama bin Laden moved around and who his bodyguards were. This is the kind of person who would have been given a pretty good deal in a U.S. court, and instead he finds himself the first witness in the dock. It would be as if the Nuremberg trials opened with the prosecution of Hitler's driver, who, by the way, died of old age in his bed without ever having been charged.
And you say that this movie day on Monday, really shed some light into what you say the flaws are of what's happening in Guantanamo, this being the first of what we expect is many other military tribunals to take place.
Well, again, I mean, the government commissioned this film. They called it the Al-Qaeda Plan, and they presented it to the jurors, to the officers who are going to decide Hamdan's fate. This was a 90-minute inflammatory video that essentially was the government's excuse or vehicle to show images of bearded Arabs firing guns, to show charred bodies, to show the plane slamming into the buildings in New York and people screaming, even though Hamdan himself, according to every government witness who has taken the stand, is not charged with involvement or planning of any terrorist attack. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that could never happen in a U.S. court, would be reversible error if it were shown in a trial like this. And it was really remarkable. And the other amazing thing about it is that the government hired a kid in his 20s as their chief al-Qaeda expert, and he's the one who made this film. This is someone who studied al-Qaeda in college, who does not speak Arabic, who's not traveled to the region. And you would think that after investing hundreds of billions of dollars in intelligence, at least since 9/11, if not before, that there would be someone within the United States government, an Arabic speaker, who could be used as an expert in al-Qaeda, and you would not need someone who has been described by others, not me, as the Doogie Howser of terrorism,
oh my God,
the government's chief expert.
What explains this? I mean, are they just going through the motions? Have they given up, or do they actually think this is going to work as a case?
Well, again, it is going to work as a case. Let's be clear. Hamdan is not here to be acquitted. He's going to be convicted. They didn't fly in all of these colonels and lieutenant colonels from around the country to come here and acquit Hamdan. The real case is going to be later on, when this case will end up in the federal courts and probably once again in the Supreme Court. So it's surprising. The government must know that they are not building a better record for the world, for posterity, and for future court review. This whole thing is really a mockery.
But having said all that, Hamdan actually is also in federal trial at the moment, isn't he? Isn't he challenging, as the Supreme Court said he could, as in a ruling earlier this year, that he could challenge his detention?
Right, and that's another remarkable thing about the trials here, is that, remember, only a handful of the 265 remaining people at Guantanamo have been charged with crimes. The rest are being held as enemy combatants in the war on terror. The government's theory being that everyone who is such an enemy combatant can be held really indefinitely, or as they say, until the cessation of hostilities in the war on terror, which sounds more like an abstraction than an actual date. Hamdan is also designated an enemy combatant, so that even if he manages to make it through this trial and is acquitted, which I've told you already is not going to happen, the government's position is that he won't be released because he's still an enemy combatant who will be held until the end of the war on terror. So simultaneously, as you pointed out, Hamdan, as well as the other hundreds of detainees here, is challenging his detention in a federal court, but that's operating on a slower schedule.
Okay, Ben Wiesner, many thanks.
Very glad to be here, and I hope you'll have me again.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Ben Wiesner, staff attorney for the ACLU's National Security Project. He's been observing Hamdan's trial in Guantanamo Bay.
What an amazing
window.
Ergo
that very scratchy telephone line there.
But what an amazing window on history, even as disheartening and as he says it's a mockery. I mean, this is a very historic case, and I mean, you can hear the energy in his voice. It's kind of miserable down there, but he's having a great time.
Well, I mean, it's certainly got to be fascinating, especially for legal minds.
Good morning, everybody. At 877-8-MY-TAKE, you can join our conversation. We're talking about incumbency. People complain about it, but do they ever actually do anything about it? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, the House is trying to apologize to African Americans for slavery and the Jim Crow laws. How would you phrase such an apology, or what would you want to hear from the House of Representatives, from Congress, from the U.S. government, if you believe you deserve an apology? 877-8-MY-TAKE. After that fascinating look at the trial going on at Guantanamo Bay, Mr. Hamdan on trial, we decided we'd take a deeper look at justice in the Bush administration. It's kind of unrelated, but it's certainly a story this week. The latest probe into the role politics plays inside the Department of Justice was made public this week. A report documents how a handful of young political appointees violated federal laws and Justice Department policies, allegedly, by hiring career employees based on the extent of their devotion to some kind of Republican ideology. Who is responsible for this? What precedent is there for this sort of thing? Joining us now is former Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration, Jamie Gorelick. She's also a partner. She's now a partner at the William Hale Law Firm. Thanks for joining us.
That would be Wilmer Hale.
Wilmer Hale, sorry about
happy
that.
Happy to join you.
It's great to have you here. First of all, there is a discussion that the tactics used within the Bush administration are unprecedented. You write in an op-ed that that's what you believe. Describe the tactics and describe how, in your view, and based on your experience at the Justice Department, they are unprecedented.
In every department, there are the vast majority of employees are civil servants who are protected in their hiring, firing, promotion, et cetera, from any political influence by law. Above them is a thin veneer of political appointees who are permitted to be chosen by the president based on politics. In the Justice Department, this distinction is perhaps more important than in any other agency or department of government. And the reason for that is this. Prosecutors exercise tremendous authority over and power over you and me. They can indict, they can charge, they can ruin reputations, they can take away liberty. And therefore, it has been recognized for decades by Republican attorneys general, by Democratic attorneys general, that the critical role that is played must be protected from politics. What happened here, literally unprecedented, was that functionaries were put in the attorney general's offices in both the Ashcroft and Gonzalez attorney general's offices to hire career people, to grab the authority for hiring career people and put those people through a political sieve, if you will.
And this was to search for particular proclivities on issues like abortion, homosexuality. There were specific tests of loyalty to the Bush administration when interviews were conducted. I guess my question broadly is, as nice as that principle seems, as you outline it there, I mean, everybody knows in Washington that the political appointees are the senior people on the White House staff. I mean, is it really that shocking to see that they would attempt to control things, even in the Justice Department? And we've known for many administrations now that, judgeships are heavily political, confirmation hearings are the result of all kinds of political vetting. So is this really that surprising?
Yes, it's surprising and shocking to both Republicans and Democrats who served in the Justice Department. Judges are, by law and under our Constitution, political appointees of the administration in power. They are Senate confirmed, and that is where the check and balance comes in, just like a political appointee like an attorney general or an assistant attorney general who might be head of a division. But if you are a career prosecutor, you are protected by law for darn good reason from having anybody ask you about your politics. It's illegal because we can't have politically motivated people making decisions about whether to prosecute.
All right,
it is actually, believe me when I say it's shocking. It is shocking.
Okay, well, if it is so shocking and unprecedented, why would, at the beginning of the Clinton administration, the attorney general designate fire or want to replace all of the attorneys in DOJ if this process was followed and these were not politically motivated attorneys, but were in fact civil servants?
The 93 U.S. attorneys, that is the people who actually head the offices in each of the districts, are indeed political employees, political appointees, and they have always been, they've always tendered their resignations or left the administration or been fired by an administration when administrations change. So that is no different. The only difference is that in the Clinton administration, they did it all in one fell swoop. Sometimes it's done over two months or 3 weeks, but those are political appointees. If I'm the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and I'm serving at the pleasure of the president, I expect to leave when that president goes out of office. That's the head of the office. That's what I meant about the thin veneer. Beneath that person, there is not a single other political appointee in that office, not one.
So, the question of whether you're civil or political is, a bit of a detail of pay scale. But it is hard to decipher here. But the principle and the point that you make is certainly very well argued. And
it may be hard to decipher if you've not ever been in the department. I can just tell you that if you ask anyone who has ever served, they know precisely the difference between a political appointee and a career. For one thing,
all right,
goes on and stays forever. They do not leave when the president changes.
No, understood. Jamie Gorelick, we're going to have to leave it there. A former deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration with an op-ed piece in the Washington Post about the situation and the unprecedented political vetting of appointees in the Bush administration. Thanks for joining us from Washington.
Sure.
Now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, Sean. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The New York Times is reporting that the Pakistani intelligence agency, a longtime American ally in the war on terror, may actually be working with militants and fueling violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Australian officials say that it was an exploding oxygen cylinder that blew a car-sized hole in the fuselage of a Qantas jet last week, forcing an emergency landing. And the wildfire still burning near Yosemite National Park has destroyed 25 homes so far and is only 15% contained. And that's a quick look at your news headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
Good morning. It's Wednesday. It's July 30th, and we're talking about incumbents. Do you vote for them or not? We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And politics is much on the minds of many in the Southwest, as it is across the country. Affirmative action is grabbing some headlines, though, in three states, Nebraska, Colorado, and Arizona. As voters ponder a proposed measure on the ballot in November, banning various programs. This week, the controversial measures bubbled onto the national scene as both presidential contenders, Senators John McCain and Barack Obama, weighed in. For more, we're joined by Scott Wong, a reporter with the Arizona Republic, who's following the story. Good morning, Scott. Thanks so much for getting up so early.
Oh, good morning. Thank you very much.
Now, tell us about this proposal in Arizona. What does it propose to ban exactly?
Well, essentially, this initiative would prevent local and state institutions from discriminating against or giving preferential treatment to any individual or group based on the following: race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. And the ban would apply to three specific areas: public hiring, public contracts, and public education. And, of course, that could include things like college admissions, and student scholarships, and other programs.
So it's a very widespread proposed ban.
Yes, that's correct.
And it's been motivated in part by Ward Connerly, who was a prominent advocate in California, who got one of these bans, a very similarly written ban, passed in California. And John McCain, one of the senators there from Arizona, he had a response to this on George this week with George Stephanopoulos. Let's listen to what he said.
Opponents of affirmative action are trying to get a referendum on the ballot here that would do away with affirmative action. Do you support that?
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I do not believe in quotas, but I have not seen the details of some of these proposals, but I've always opposed
But the
quotas.
One here in Arizona you support?
I support it, yes.
Is that what's at issue here, quotas? And how was his response taken there in Arizona?
Well, actually, the problem with that statement is that the initiative doesn't address quotas. And we heard John McCain say that, you know, he opposes any type of quota system. In fact, he's long opposed that. But this initiative doesn't address quotas. It just says that preferential treatment may not be given based on race and gender.
And immediately Barack Obama said, wait a second, John McCain has actually flip-flopped on this issue. Let's listen to what Obama said.
I am disappointed, though, that John McCain flipped and changed his position. I think in the past he had been opposed to these kinds of Ward-Carnally referenda or initiatives as divisive. And I think he's right. The truth of the matter is these are not designed to solve a big problem.
So how is this going over, Scott, in Arizona? Is it getting a lot of attention in the press, or is this something that the national media is making more of than the folks in Arizona?
No, I think it is getting attention in the press, and this is an issue that we've been following for several months. There's been there's been political battles. There's been, fights, not fights, but there's been, disputes in the streets as people are collecting signatures for this initiative. There's been, Ward Connerly himself has poured about $1 million into the state here in order to promote his issue. And so, there's lots of publicity and there's lots of money coming here to Arizona over this particular issue.
How's it polling?
Well, it's hard to say. What we do know is that, these petition gatherers out on the street collected well more than the 250,000 signatures needed to place this initiative on the ballot. I think it was upward of 300,000. So they did manage to get the signatures, and now the Secretary of State's office is reviewing those signatures, determining whether they have enough ballot signatures to put it on the ballot. There seems to be support for this type of issue. And, one thing that the opponents say is that, the way we can fight this initiative is to keep it off the ballot in the first place. That's why we've seen such a big effort in trying to block the initiative from getting on, because I think they know once it passes, once it gets on that ballot, voters are likely to pass it.
So there is an organized opposition.
Yeah, it's interesting. Opponents say that, look, Ward Connerly, he's from California. He's coming into the state and putting an initiative on our ballot here in Arizona, on the ballots in Colorado and Nebraska. But at the same time, there's opposition coming from out of state as well. A group called BAM, By Any Means Necessary, out of Michigan,
right,
has been out here trying to block the signature gathering effort.
So we're certainly going to hear lots more about this story, Scott.
Yes, definitely.
Scott Wong, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Wong, State Capitol reporter for the Arizona Republic. And now we get some headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Good morning. 21 minutes to the hour. President Bush has signed a massive housing bill intended to provide mortgage relief for struggling homeowners and stabilize financial markets. Ex-Bosnian leader Radovan Karadzic arrived by helicopter at The Hague this morning, where he faced war crimes charges. Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican senator, says he's innocent and will prove it after his indictment yesterday for accepting illegal gifts from an oil company. Scientists say that yesterday's 5.4 magnitude California earthquake wasn't the big one, but served as a good drill. And staying in California, more news from Los Angeles. During the quake, the Los Angeles City Council voted unanimously to put a ban on new fast food restaurants in one of the city's poorest areas. Now, the mayor still has to approve the ban, but it's expected that he will. The southern part of Los Angeles has a huge, huge problem with obesity, so the council's decided to step in. They're going to ban for 1 year the building of any new fast food restaurants. The area right now is about a 32-square-mile area, has 400 fast food restaurants. Now, the restaurants concerned are not very happy with this. In fact, one fast food restaurant owner says that obesity is principally related to what and how much a consumer eats, not where he eats. So,
it's going to be really hard to drive the cars into Spago, actually, and get dinner and lunch there. That's going to be very, very hard.
The obesity rate for that part of the country, 30% of children in the area are obese compared to 21% in the rest of Los Angeles.
And there's nothing funny about that. I mean, I guess the question is, can they politically make this ban stick?
Or legally, for that matter.
Well, it was a unanimous vote. I mean, 13 to none. So it's just a question of whether the mayor will pass it. And it's not about you can't eat here. They're just not going to build any more restaurants, fast food restaurants, for an entire year.
No, we had this big argument yesterday over where fast food was invented. Some of the staff said Los Angeles, said Chicago.
No, one staff member, Colin, said California.
You may be right. Anyway, thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
So we go now to Beijing, where the Olympics are about 10 days away, and the International Olympic Committee has overturned a decision banning Iraq from this year's Olympics. The move came yesterday after last-minute talks in Switzerland, during which Iraq promised to hold free elections for its National Olympic Committee under international observation. We're joined on the line from Beijing by our content editorial partner, BBC Sports News correspondent Gordon Farker. Thanks for being with us.
That's a pleasure.
Gordon, how's the air there in Beijing today?
Well, it's not too bad today. The day I arrived on Monday was absolutely terrible. But then, you know, as everybody knows, it's here. When the wind blows in the right direction, the sky's clear, it can look pretty sunny and everything looks rosy. But I think it will entirely depend on which way the wind blows if they're going to get lucky for the opening ceremony.
Well, the wind is blowing towards Iraq, or at least favorably on Iraq, on this latest decision. What was the issue? Independence for the National Olympic Committee? That's a requirement?
Yeah, I mean, it all got really rather messy. I mean, the unfortunate thing, of course, is that it took some real last-minute diplomacy for this to happen, which meant that some Iraqi athletes have now missed out on a chance to compete here because, you know, the diplomacy was so tight that the deadline for registering most athletes actually expired, which has left only two athletes able to take part, and that is a bit of a pity, really. But
so let's go through the list. Out of luck are archery, judo, rowing, and weightlifting, but apparently a discus thrower and a sprinter will be at the Games.
That's right. Haider Nazir, a discus thrower, and Danmar Hussein, a sprinter. They are the two that are coming. And also, of course, because the status is now reconferred on the team, there'll be some observers from the National Olympic Committee as well, or what passes for the National Olympic Committee in Iraq at the moment. So there'll be basically seven people there. So at least they can carry a flag and look like a team when they get into the stadium. Yeah.
I mean, we sort of laugh about the bureaucracy of the Olympics, and, you know, we could talk endlessly about that in this segment, but really it is important nationally for the people of Iraq to have a presence at the Olympics, right?
Oh, I think so, and I think the IOC have said that all along. The problem is that for the IOC, you know, their rules and regulations say that there shouldn't be any interference in the running of the National Olympic Committee, and of course, the Iraqi government rather heavily interfered by sacking the entire lot of them back in May. Now, they had reasons for doing that. They say good reasons. They say they had hard evidence of corruption, of blatant corruption, lack of legitimate, transparent electoral processes and accountability, to be precise. I mean, that was what they believed was going on there, but the IOC's argument is, well, look, the National Olympic Committees are elected effectively by the national sports federations. It's nothing to do with government. It's not a government appointee job, this. It's sport that chooses these people. It's the sports people that we recognise. Now, clearly, what needed to happen to resolve this was for some free elections to take place, which the IOC was prepared to recognise in order for the National Olympic Committee to be re-established. Now, those haven't happened yet. There is a promise now from the Iraqi government that they will be held, and that will be monitored by the Olympic Council of Asia. So at least they've taken the steps in the direction the IOC wanted to see.
Well, and if you go back to the Cold War in Eastern Europe, this notion of independence is a bit of a term of art. Quickly before we go, any chance the discus thrower and the sprinter can make it into the medal rounds?
I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, their greatest achievement is making it, you know, into the opening ceremony to march behind the flag in the first place.
All right, Gordon Farker, BBC Sports News correspondent, who says the air in Beijing is not bad today. Thanks for joining us. Gordon Farker of the BBC. Air's decent today.
Good morning. We have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. 12 minutes to the hour. President Bush has signed a massive housing bill that offers a temporary financial lifeline to troubled mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In an historic vote, the House has apologized for the persecution of African Americans as they suffered under slavery and Jim Crow laws. It's the first time that Congress has officially apologized. North Korea is facing its worst food crisis in more than a decade because of flooding and poor harvests. The World Food Programme says that millions of people are in danger. And just a wrap of your Olympic news for this morning. There's been an allegation about harassment of Christians in China. That allegation comes from Reverend Bob Fu, of the president of the China Aid Association here in the U.S.
Numerous house churches in Beijing since the end of April have been attacked. The pulpit were knocked down. Some pastors were even beaten up. Believers were interrogated.
China also announced today that internet access would be limited to visitors and journalists during the Beijing Olympics. And just on a good note, a positive note, two Iraqi athletes just managed to get their submission in time, and they will be taking part in the Beijing Olympics.
Sprinter and a discus thrower who, according to our buddy in Beijing, says they don't have a chance to do anything but be in the opening ceremony.
Yeah, but it's just nice. Iraq's been through a lot. And it's got to be a rallying point for some folks who want to see their athletes do well.
Yeah, I'm sure the crowd would cheer for them very loudly.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
John?
So, transportation officials, actually the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, released a report Monday stating that at least $140 billion are needed to make repairs or upgrades to one of every four bridges in the United States. Now, there's some timing to this report. It's coming out only days before the one-year anniversary of the devastating Minneapolis 35W bridge collapse. This pairing is a sobering reminder of the country's crumbling and outmoded infrastructure, something that will cost billions and billions to repair. Minnesota Public Radio's C. Stachura has been covering the Minneapolis bridge collapse, and she joins us on the line. C, certainly we need to know the status of the 35W bridge, but I'm wondering what people in Minnesota are thinking of this report.
I think they're saying it's a reflection of exactly what we've been talking about for the last year, that infrastructure is underfunded and it's falling apart underneath our feet.
So what is the status of the reconstruction? And, you know, what's interesting in a lot of these reconstructions is that the cost of repairs exceeds the cost of even a replacement bridge. So describe how close we are to actually reopening the bridge fully.
The bridge itself looks completely done at this point, but it's not. It's still being surfaced, and so it will be open approximately mid-September. That's not in time for the Republican National Convention, which is September 1st through the 3rd, but it actually is several months ahead of schedule.
Which is actually quite surprising. This bridge was put up very quickly.
Yeah, that's fairly unusual, although it's not unheard of. What they did was 24 hours, 6 days a week of work. The only time they ever stopped was when the weather was absolutely too cold or there was lightning in the area.
What's the price tag?
We're talking in the $300 million range for this bridge. And, you know, I'm sorry, I can't tell you right off the top of my head what the overall total is, but it's been a combination of state and federal dollars. And that means that some of Minnesota's state dollars have been borrowed from other projects to make this happen within a year.
Well, certainly the cost, just in dollar terms, far exceeds what it must have cost to put that bridge up back in 1967. And I guess what the people of Minnesota have learned here is that there is a certain cost of letting this become a tragedy before you address it. And, you know, obviously the loss of life is right there at the top of the list. But is there a way strategically to address this issue before there's a tragedy? And is the state of Minnesota investigating how to do that?
I think it's a matter of each state deciding how to deal with its problem individually, because bridges are funded through state and federal dollars. And federally, the Highway Trust Fund, which provides pretty much all of the federal dollars for these bridge projects, is nearly bankrupt. Statewide, it's dependent on how many dollars each state puts toward its transportation. In Minnesota, the gas tax, which again funds largely these highway and bridge projects, hadn't been increased since the 80s. And it was increased this past year, but only after the state legislature overrode a veto by the governor. This really is dependent on what is the political will of the state. Are they willing to say, yeah, we're going to raise taxes so that we can fix our bridges and roads?
But there's no, I mean, you would never run anything like this. I mean, you'd have an endowment in place for capital costs and capital expenditures. If you have to raise taxes every time you fix something, it's never going to get done. And last Saturday, what, 1,200 pounds of concrete fell from another bridge in St. Paul?
Yeah, this is a problem that we've been dealing with for decades. Most of the country's bridges were built in the 50s and 60s. And since then, as the American Association of State Highway Transportation officials, that report put out, they said, we've been working off of this investment we made 50 years ago. And today, we're seeing the consequences of not putting money aside for repairs later on.
Let's go back to your point about the Federal Highway Fund. You say it's almost bankrupt?
Yeah, the Highway Trust Fund. Now, this is related to two things that are going on. One, for the first time since the Department of Transportation has been recording how many miles people drive every year, people have driven actually fewer miles this past year. And that means a couple of things. One, they're buying less gas. And secondly, because most people are now driving more fuel-efficient vehicles, again, they're buying less gas. So there's just not that much money in that trust fund. And as prices for diesel and gasoline go up, for concrete, for steel, as these prices rise, the money that is there just doesn't go very far.
So at the very moment that we need to repair this infrastructure, as the time that these bridges are getting, you know, to be 50 years old, all of the incentives are in place to decrease the funding for any kinds of repairs, both nationally and at the state level.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good, does it?
Oh, that sounds really awful.
Yeah, and this report that came out on Monday says exactly that. It says if we don't do something quickly, nationally and on state levels, we're going to see a decrease, a 50% decrease in the amount of pothole covering and bridge rebuilding that can be done nationally. On top of that, we're also looking at just basically an infrastructure that not only is falling apart, but is also just not big enough to handle the amount of traffic that we're actually seeing. So you couldn't even get semis across some of these bridges in the state, in the nation. So
see, how do you measure the political will, not only in Minnesota, obviously, given the terrible tragedy that happened there a year ago, but more generally in the face of these dwindling dollars and the $140 billion need?
I think there is an increased political will in, I'm going to say, the federal level. I'm not sure. I can't speak for all the rest of the states. I think in Minnesota, the legislature has taken on the burden of what do we do about these bridges, in part because it helps them politically. Nationally, the House Transportation Committee, chaired by Jim Oberstar of Minnesota, put out a bridge bill that would both change the way that bridges are rated, so it's actually more, it has a stronger correlation to how safe is this bridge for people crossing it, and it provides $1 billion in emergency funding. But as John said at the top, we need $140 billion to fix all these bridges.
And it's easy to talk at the national level. It's really about where the dollars are actually deployed. Cees Tatura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Cees Tatura is there in Minnesota on the bridge itself, reporting for Minnesota Public Radio. Actually, not literally on the bridge, but she's been covering the bridge collapse, which will be a year ago exactly in just a couple of days.
And they're almost done with that bridge, which is fascinating.
We're always on here at The Takeaway. You can find us online, streaming at FriendFeed on Facebook. You can come around to thetakeaway.org and visit us.
We've been talking about apologies today. The House apologized yesterday to African Americans for the wrongs committed during slavery and the Jim Crow segregation law era. The resolution marks the first time Congress has ever formally apologized for America's past history of slavery and legally enforced discrimination.
Which inspired Cheryl from Clifton to call our Spinbox line about a sort of apology she once received.
I used to run survivor groups for incest and rape survivors. And one day a man took me to lunch and took me for a walk. And he thanked me for my ministry. And then he said, in a kind of a tearful voice, that he knew that a lot of men had hurt me in my life, and he wanted to ask my forgiveness on behalf of all men. It was a powerful, powerful moment for me, and I feel like I owe a lot of forgiveness to him. So I wanted to let you know, apologies work, even if you're not the one who directly sinned.
Oh, the importance of apologies.
Yeah.
That's great. Here's the takeaway for today's hour.
I think it will entirely depend on which way the wind blows.
Gordon Farker talking about the air in Beijing.
And tomorrow we'll be talking about Cuba.
All right, we want to hear from you, of course, at 877-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and we're out of time.